Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. So today's book that I'm going to talk about is the follow-up to a multi-award-winning book called Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. I read and reviewed that one back. Let me just quickly look it up. I read and reviewed that one back on episode 218, and I gave it 3.5 stars, and it went on to, like I say, win the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award and stuff like that. So anyway, there's this follow-up book came out called Ancillary Sword, which came out just over a year ago, back in October 2014, Ancillary Sword. And just last month, the follow-up book to this one, like the third book in a trilogy, came out, and it's called, let me have a look now, Ancillary Mercy, came out in 2015. So I'm going to be talking about the middle book in a trilogy, which is always a bit of a tricky job to do, because I'm thinking, well, okay, I don't want to spoil too much in the first book, but I still want to talk about the second book in depth, so I'm not going to spoil that much about the first book, except I do, the start of this book really does follow on from the end of the last book, and as I finish the end of the last book I read before this. So at the end of there, you're going, oh, okay, this is a standalone novel. Is it a standalone novel? Well, I guess it does stand alone, but at the end it does say, and now let's set up for the continuing adventures of Breck. And Breck is the main character of the first one. This time, she gets given a spaceship for her continuing adventures. And I was thinking, oh, great. So we've had like this space opera-y kind of military science fiction. And at the end, it's like, and now you have your spaceship and you're going to be the commander of the spaceship. And now you're going to go out and do the bidding of the emperor or empress and go on adventures. And I was like, well, how adventurous is this going to be? What kind of adventures is someone going to get? Breck, the kind of person Breck is going to get up to? So yeah, this book also nominated for different awards. I think nominated for the Nebula and the Hugo, didn't win either of them. But as I was going into this book, I was thinking, oh, well, I read two of the other books that were nominated for the Hugo Award this year, The Three-Body Problem and The Goblin Emperor. The Three-Body Problem I gave 1.5 stars. The Goblin Emperor I gave 2 stars. Three-Body Problem 1. But I was like, could The Three-Body Problem have been the best book of the year? And this is always my issues with the Hugo Awards. I don't even know why I keep talking about it so much, but because I always feel disappointed with the choices that people do in the nominations and the winners of these things. So when this one, and yes, this is actually, I think, a better novel. Certainly a better written novel than The Three-Body Problem, and has a more interesting story than The Goblin Emperor, although I think The Goblin Emperor is in some ways written slightly better on, you know, a sentence-by-sentence basis, but this is just way better than both of those two put together. Not a perfect book, but I'll get onto that. So let's just set up the world of this. Like I say, at the end of the last book, again, mild spoilers, there are many solar system-wide empire, and it's ruled by the Empress, the Ananda Mienai, and it's kind of lots of different people are the Empress. There's lots of different, it's like a hive mind spread among lots and lots and lots and lots of different humans, which are bred and raised and and taught to be, but also they're linked together in with these implants that connect people's minds together. And we find out, again, mild spoilers, that the Emperor isn't just one Emperor. There's like different factions within the Emperor, and they're fighting among themselves. So what happens is, at the end of the previous book, Ancillary Justice, part of the Emperor goes and goes, okay, Breck, you're going to work for us. And Breck is what's called an ancillary. So starships also have kind of a hive mind, but not really a hive mind. It's more like an artificial intelligence which is running the ship, but they have lots of people working for them who don't have minds of their own. They're controlled as ancillaries. They have implants in as well, so the ship can control them individually. And Breck used to be a ship, but then everything about her was destroyed. The ship was destroyed, all the other ancillaries destroyed, all the different computers, all the different parts of the body and mind were destroyed, except for one ancillary, and that's the one that survived. So we have this main character called Breck, and she isn't a human, or her body was once human, but the mind has been wiped and replaced by the ship's mind, and then the ship's mind has been destroyed, and so that's it. So we have this weird situation where a former ship, which used to have a ship's mind, is now in an ancillary, and the ancillary is now in another ship, which is being controlled by a different mind, but Breck is now the captain of this new ship. And so you think, okay, like, this is what's happening at the end of the last book. What are the adventures that she's going to go on? What kind of things is she going to get up with? On these continuing adventures. Now, the first book did feel a lot kind of like a space opera and military science fiction. Was this book is the scale seems to have been like restricted quite a lot, because even though the first book it was mostly set on one planet and then on another planet and then a space station, here it's just like, okay, everything's happening in one system. And also the first book, it was like, okay, this is happening back, this is backstory, and now we'll have a chapter of now story, and then we'll go back and do backstory, and then we kept on flicking between two different timelines, which I really enjoyed for the first two thirds of Ancillary Justice. And then at the end it just goes, okay, and now we're going to have a linear plot, and it got really boring for the last third of Ancillary Justice. It was felt very uneven in that way. And this book has been evened out in that there is no skipping backwards and forwards in time. It's a very linear plot. However, and this is a clever thing for the writing, is that there are different viewpoint characters. Not in that the narrative switches between different viewpoints of characters. It's that now, because Breck is an ancillary, and she is now on a ship. The ship also doesn't have ancillaries, but has crew members. And these crew members also have the implant. So anywhere that there's a crew member from the ship knows what's going on. The ship can follow along. And because Breck has got like these two-way implants, she can also follow along and see what's happening, because she's got authority over everyone there as well. So at some points, Breck will be down on a planet and there'll be a ship in space, and she'll be like, and now at this moment, while I'm having this conversation with this other person, I'm seeing what this person is saying and doing over here. And now when this is going on over here, I'm also seeing there. So sometimes you can have like four different viewpoints all happening at the same time. Someone on a planet, someone on a ship, someone on a at another part of the planet, and then someone on a space station, and you get kind of getting picking up. And I really enjoyed that kind of storytelling. I do think it was almost underused. It could have been used more in the book, but it kept on being sprinkled through to remind you, this person is not a human. This person used to be a ship who was doing this, all this kind of stuff all the time, had all these memories, could see all these different viewpoints, could, like, if they have like hundreds of ancillaries, they're getting feeds from the ancillaries all the time. And this person, Breck, who is a human body, is not a human at all. So that's kind of what happens. That's the thing that kind of sets this story apart from the first one. We got a lot of that in the first one told from the point of view of a ship seeing all these different viewpoints, whereas here it's sort of like much more of a human scale. It's kind of a lot easier to get your head around, or get it, like, to kind of conceptualize that in the brain, which in a way is easier to understand, but also less challenging. What I liked about the first book, in that first two thirds of the first book, is that it is kind of like there's something new going on here. There's something weird going on here, with lots of different connections and different people and people like connecting brains together, and lots of, sort of like, what is, if I am all of these different people in all these different places, where is me? Where am I? Like, what part of that? And that's kind of really restricted down. In fact, all this entire book is restricted in scope. First of all, the inner identity personality stuff is restricted down just to Breck and telling her story and sort of following along. But also the scale, like I said, the first book is spread over lots of different planets and different things. Here, it's like there's one planet, there's two ships, and there's a space station, and that's it. And even when we go down onto the planet, I only really go to one place on the planet. Don't really see a lot of stuff, don't travel around a lot. And when you're on the space station, it's pretty much like two places that they go. There's a garden that they go to, and then there's some kind of slum area underneath the garden called the Undergarden. And all of the action takes place in the Undergarden and the garden. Sometimes it may be in an office, but very nondescript office. So, so it's really strange that at the end of the first book, it's like, and now you have a spaceship and can go off and have adventures. And you're like, well, they hardly even spent any time in the ship. They only went to one place. There was only like one trip through a wormhole. Not a lot of, no space battles going on, nothing like that at all. It's just sort of like, and we set off and we arrive at a space station. And now we go on a space station and down to the planet and then back up to the space station. But that's it. So yeah, a lot smaller world. It felt not claustrophobic, but a lot smaller. So there's a kind of setup on the world there. Lots of people have said this is very much like, the first book they were saying, it feels like Ian M. Banks, The Culture kind of thing. And I understand why people say that. I don't get the that it's that close, but there are ships, and ships have minds, and ships kind of have drones, even though they're made out of humans. But there is that kind of power an imbalance with the ships knowing everything and doing everything, and then the humans trying to feel like they're kind of important as well. So it's a little bit there. So anyway, the story of this, someone, I think it was Tamahomi, mentioned on Goodreads on my review. He said, I've heard it called Downton Abbey in space. Now, I've never seen Downton Abbey, but I know the kind of setup there of an English manor house and the lords and ladies and doing this and meeting up, and there's lots of social things, and it's all very, really? I do say. And lots of tea drinking. And this is all about that. There's lots of tea drinking. In fact, one of the first kind of conflicts of the book, or one of the first things that stands out in the book, is that someone says, we need a proper tea set. And I'm like, really? You need a proper tea set? It's like, yes, we need a proper tea set. We're going to a place where everyone has tea. And if you have a proper tea set, you will, like a very expensive china tea set, you will be able to, that's what your rank should be. And we've only got really shit stuff. And she's like, and Breck is like, okay. Number five, go back to the emperor and ask and see if you can find a nice tea set, because we're going to tea country. We're going to the planet where all the tea comes from, and tea is very important in this empire. A bit like the British Empire in that way, I guess. It's all like, yes, well, all the it's the tea is worth more than its weight in silver, or whatever it was. You know, when the tea first started coming from India to Britain, that was the whole point. It's sort of like, hey, we need a something that's grown over in the East, which we can bring back to the West and still sell for a profit. And tea was the thing that they found. And it was kind of like a fake economy, but it was one of those things where it's sort of like, we will now sell tea. And of course, tea is very nice. So it's sort of like, okay, a tea set. And I was like, well, this tea set's going to be important later. And it turns out, yes, tea sets are very important. It almost felt like a Chekhov's tea set in that it was like, we're in the first chapter, in the first act, we're seeing a tea set, and then we're going to get some more. And then so they go off and they have to secure, this is Breck's mission, there's a war going on, a civil war going on, go to the planet where all the tea comes from and secure the planet and make sure that nothing goes wrong in this system, because we need to keep the tea flowing. Or we need to keep this planet safe and things. So this whole system, it's your job to secure this. And because it's a civil war and you're not quite sure who's in charge with the emperor, who is kind of splitting apart and has different factions within it, it's like, okay. And so Brett kind of makes the decision that I'm going to be in charge. And even if the emperor says something, I'm going to ignore it. I have to make sure that this place is secure. So Breck turns up in the system, and while in the first book Breck is just like this person who doesn't have a lot of power and is kind of on the edges of society and trying to make a way through the book, in this it's like she turns up and she is in charge, which made me think a bit like and in fact there was this feeling that this book did feel a bit like the what's the book? The Vorkosigan saga books, but without the annoying kid in it, without Miles Vorkosigan. It did feel a bit like Barrier and what was the other book that I was going to look at? I can't remember. Shards of Honor as well. So it's sort of like, okay, I'm the prime minister of this country, but I'm going to get into these situations, and it's like, and I have to use my intelligence to get through it, but then I'll have an adventure in the backcountry, but then there'll be houses and servants and love affairs between different people and bodyguards and more servants and tea drinking. Kind of, it did feel a bit like that, but not as annoying as when Miles Vorkosigan ever turns up. I can't remember what Miles Vorkosigan's parents were called in Shards of Horror and Barrier, but it felt a lot more more like that. So yes, so then she turns up on the space station, and there's a garden with a pond in it, and I'm like, wow, this is Chekhov's Chekhov's garden pond, and it seems to be set up in this way that you're just thinking, well, at the end of the book, there's going to be everything that's going to go down. And then she leaves and she goes down to the planet. I was like, well, she's got to go back up to the space station again, because we've got to have the big showdown at the pond. And then later on, it's like, yep, the pond is the location of the big showdown at the end. And then she gets down. And I was like, wow, this is Chekhov's bathhouse as well. You're talking about going for a bath very early in the morning numerous times. I bet this is going to have a big thing. It's like, and yep, there it is. And there's a few times through this where it's just like, but this is really, not in a bad way, but like kind of really obvious in the way that the first book didn't have, mainly because it didn't feel like the plot was like properly, or the story was properly plotted out. It was just like, oh, and now the big thing that's going to go at the end is like, oh, I'm just going to find a gun and shoot the person, which made me think of the latest Bond movie, which I thought was okay, but very disappointing, because every single time that James Bond arrives somewhere, he's like, well, what I need to do is I have a gun and I'm just going to go into this house with my gun and whatever happens, happens. And I'm like, really? That's the plan, is that you have a gun and you're just going in? And then there's another place that's like, and now I'm at the Vatican City and I've got a gun and now I'm just going in. I'm like, really? That's it? You just go. And there's another place. And then there's a big the lair of the main bad guys, and I have a gun and I'm just going in. I was like, really? That's the plan? And then at the end of the Bond movie, it's sort of like, and now he's going to the MI5 headquarters and there's going to be a trap then. And he's like, well, I have a gun, so I'm just going in. I was like, really? That's the plan? All the plan is like, you've got a gun and you're just going in. Unlike a movie that I watched 2 days ago, which is the latest Mission Impossible movie. It's like, we're going in and we have this 22-step plan and everything has to go correct in this 22-step plan or else it will fail. And then the next situation is like, aha, now we've got a 31-step plan. And if everything goes correct in the 31-step, and the next one's like, oh, this is a much more simple plan. There's only 15 steps that have to go exactly right for this plan to be pulled off. And they do actually make a joke about that in the movie, saying, well, this goes right is indistinguishable from luck. It seems just lucky chance that all this is going correctly and that the plans always come together, which is quite interesting. And in this book, it did feel like, again, it's like, oh, we're just going in. But it felt like the author and Leckie seemed to have a bit more of an idea of like, oh, this is what's going to happen at the end of the book. So it's not just going to be like, and I have a gun and I'm just going in with a gun. Even though the plan, there doesn't ever seem to be like a Mission Impossible style plan, which is what I like, I guess, with my action, is that someone doesn't just go, I have a gun and I'm turning up. What happens? I'm more of a like, hey, we've got this idea and now let's execute on this idea. It really did feel like this book had more of a, I've got a story that I want to tell and I'm going to work my way through the story. Even though I do think like the setup is slightly less interesting and the world building is less interesting in this book than in Ancillary Sword than in Ancillary Justice. So yes, it's all of the world and the society is all like, oh, so we are having tea, are we? Yes, we are having tea. Oh, and what is the proper thing to do in this situation? Well, I do believe they're not actually talking about this, but it's all inside the minds of the people. It's like, well, proprietary means we need to, oh, and it's the decent thing to do, and this is the beneficial thing to do, and this is all great. Which brings me on to the, what have I got here? The characters. Breck is not human. And what I really liked about this book is that the main character is not human, but is having to interact with human things, but the thought processes are always like this kind of one step removed. We never really understand why Breck is thinking what she is thinking and doing what she was doing, but we do see her doing it all. And everybody else thinks, or like most of the other people think that Breck is human and they're taken in with her act, but she comes across as kind of cold and slightly unlikable, and she has to surround herself. She realizes that she has to surround herself with other people who are either understand what situation she's in or are a little bit more human, so she can kind of like work with other people through other people who, you know, not as an ancillary, but she does seem to, because she used to be a ship's mind, she kind of seems to use people as though they are still ancillaries, even though she understands that they're actually humans and that they have human thoughts and human desires and human everything about them. She still has to kind of use them as tools to get through her life. That's interesting. And like I mentioned before about the different viewpoints, I really like the switching of viewpoints, that they go, oh, I'll go over and have a look here and then go over and have a look here. Now, there's other characters. There's Tissawat, who is a young lieutenant, And if anything felt a bit too Miles Vorkosigan, it was that situation there. It was like, oh, and I've got a crush on this person, and this person is it. And you're like, oh, okay, wait, whatever. And there's some other people, not really that important. I guess there's someone called, I don't know how to pronounce the names. There's Fossif, I guess, and Rofford, which is a mother and daughter, or father and son. Oh, actually, it's a clone. One of them is a clone. Rofford is the clone of the parent. Which brings me on to this other factor here about this book, which I thought was quite interesting in the first book, and lots of people seem to bring up and talk about in a way which I thought was not overblown, but like it kind of became the focus of the first book, where I don't think that should have been the focus of the first book. And it kind of, I guess, could become a focus of this book, but I don't think it is the focus. It's just the idea that the people in the Radchai, is it Radchai? The Imperial Radchai, I don't know. Anyway, it's a group of people, and they don't distinguish among themselves with gendered pronouns. They don't say he or she. It's just, hey, you, they do this. But of course, in the book, everything that Anne Leggie has just decided to translate this non-gendered pronoun, so everyone has a female pronoun. And that's, so everyone is a she, and she does this, and it's hers, and they go this way, and there are no sons and fathers, it's just mothers and daughters, excuse me. And what I really like about this is that it's just really refreshing that when a character turns up, you don't immediately think, ah, this person is the love interest, because the main character is male and this person is female, and so there we go. Or this person turns up, well, she is going to have to be rescued by the main character because she is female, and then she is a damsel in distress and needs rescuing. And it's kind of refreshing in that way, that all of that is just removed. All of the expectations of character are removed, and you get to know the characters by what they do and what they say, rather than their gender, which, again, is very refreshing. And while I don't think this book benefits from this in the same way that the previous book did, the Ancillary Justice, it kind of felt fresh there. It did actually, and it kind of was used a bit more than in this book, it did still feel interesting. And I was just thinking, like, it's not really needed in this book, but it is refreshing. And even though it's been done before in the previous book, and I've seen the similar things been done in other books, but I was like, why? That's what we should do. Is I'd like on my Kindle or iBook or whatever ebook reader, I would really love a filter which just goes through and just replaces all of the gendered pronouns with, not the opposite gender, but like, or just a non-specific gender. I think there's an Alistair Reynolds book, I can't remember which one, but there's a non-gendered character there, and the pronouns are like V does this instead of he or she, it's V, and it belongs to Vim, or no, Ver, it's Vers, and it's like everything is the V prefix or the V, and I was like, ah, that makes a lot of sense. And I was like, well, let's just do that. Let's just have a button that I can press in a Kindle book, and everyone's gender is just faded into the background. Now, while I think that's kind of interesting, I thought it was more interesting in the first book, in Ancillary Justice, in this second book, Ancillary Sword, it feels like the characters, it was a bit too easy to guess the gender of this character, that character, in a way that it felt like, because we're actually spending more time with the individual characters, like Tissawat, we spend a lot more time with her, and Rofford and Forsyth and these other characters, I'm like, we're spending almost too much time for me to ignore what the written gender is. Whereas in the first book, it felt like Anne Leckie, as the author, wasn't interested and didn't care what gender any of the characters were, and so it felt like it fell into the background. Here, it really does feel like all of these characters were written gendered, and then she did apply the filter to take out the genders, because some of them felt a bit too, I don't want to say it, like stereotypically male and stereotypically female, or in the stereotypical female roles compared to the stereotypical male roles. I'm not entirely sure how to put that, but it felt a bit less, less subtle in this book And it felt like the non-gender pronouns were kind of papering over something rather than being a focus of the book. So that's all I've got to say about that. And the characters themselves, some of them a bit too, and now enter the cartoon villain, and now enter the cartoon villain's daughter, who is also going to be villainous, and but the cartoon villain actually not so bad, and because someone else, you know, and I was like, oh great, okay, it felt a bit, some of the characters felt a little bit not so great, but overall okay. I enjoyed looking at these characters through the eyes of Breck, our main character, because she is not human. So everything that happens, she is seeing it through a slightly disjointed eye. Like everything else that's happened, even between humans, they wouldn't notice it. But because she's not human, it's sort of like, ah, this is actually teasing out. So it's kind of like a more interesting take on slightly too flat characters for in a normal book. But here it works because we're seeing it through a mirror darkly, whatever. Coming to, oh yeah, the themes of the book. That's what I normally finish up with when I talk about these reviews. There's a lot going on in this book. Some of it is really, really there on the surface. Like, oh, poor people, we should look after the poor. Oh, there's empires and lots of people are taken away from their countries and displaced and made into serfs and sold into slavery. Slavery is bad, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, I agree. I agree, slavery is bad. Oh, and it's bad to keep people in serfdom in a farm. They should be able to, they shouldn't have to buy everything. Like, if we're the only people that can sell them stuff and they have to buy from us, the company store can charge them what we want. And every bit of money that we pay them, we get back and more. They have to take loans out just to live. Isn't that bad? And I'm like, yeah, that is bad. So that kind of, like, the politically, that kind of thing is a little bit heavy-handed, because that's the thing that Breck is going, no, this is bad, we shouldn't do this, and everyone else is saying, ah, you came in, and as soon as you arrived here, you went and talked, you went and found rooms in this slum area where, and then made friends with all the people, and that rubs us up the wrong way, and then you go this, and straight away you go to the serfs, and that really rubs us up the wrong way, and I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, we get that, because that's all on the surface, it's like that, but there's a lot of stuff underneath the surface, which I actually think is more of the strength in the book. Again, that whole idea of playing with like identity, gender stuff, slightly, not so much, but is there as well. But the but you know, and the idea of, you know, power and stuff. But again, it's a little bit wishy-washy in a way. Like when it comes to the surface, it feels a bit too preachy, but when it's not on the surface, it feels a bit like a little bit a bit easy and a bit obvious sometimes. But not bad. It's just it felt a lot more comfortable, especially than the first book and many other books. Which brings me, I guess, to the conclusion, which is actually I enjoyed this book more than the first book. I don't think it's a better book, but in the first book, I really enjoyed that first two thirds, and then the end, it all kind of fell apart. So I was left at the end of it going, oh, that was like, on average, was good at the start, fell apart at the end. Whereas this book was kind of just like, oh, it's kind of like average all the way through. It starts off it's like a lot more even book. There's none of these ups and downs in the book. It just keeps kind of plodding along, very, very comfortable. And that's another reason why I thought it felt a bit like the Vorkosigan books, where everything is kind of comfortable. Like there's not a lot of bad stuff going on, and if it is bad stuff going on, well, it's all about people getting on. Oh, isn't it nice that everyone gets on? And if they don't get on, it's very nice. And it just felt kind of nice. So it seemed to be that Anne Leckie wrote the first book, and then was like, wow, okay, that was probably a little bit too ambitious for the author's skills. And then in the second book, she was like, okay, this is the middle book in a trilogy. I just need to tell a story, it's just going to sell, and I'm going to aim for something a little bit less ambitious. And I think she pulls off a less ambitious novel better than the ambitious novel in the first one. So I'm going to give this 3.5 stars, which was weirdly enough, I thought, oh, this is actually kind of more even book, and maybe I enjoyed it better than the first book, even though I think there's actually better stuff in the first book. And so I went back and looked at, oh, what did I give the first book? Turns out 3.5 stars. But it's weird that I can give two books in a series a different rating. Oh, no, the same rating, but for different reasons. The first book could have been a 5-star book, but fell flat at the end fell flat for me in a few different areas, which brought it down to 3.5-star book. But when I was going into it, I was like, I totally understand why this is winning all the awards and getting all the award buzz and all that kind of stuff. But I never, this book, even though I thought it was overall okay, it was overall a 3/3.5-star book, it never felt like there was any greatness in this book. And in Ancillary Justice, I felt that there was greatness in it, which wasn't quite, you know, the potential greatness wasn't quite achieved. Whereas in this book, it felt like there was no potential greatness. There was just an okay book from the start to finish, which I didn't expect very much going in. And it met my expectations as a decent book, which I know that's not a very glowing review. But if you read this book, there's nothing offensive in it. It might be a bit simple, but there's nothing that you're going to go, oh man, I wish it was more like this, because it is what it is. It sets out to be a certain book. It sets up the Chekhov's pond and the Chekhov's tea set. And people say it's like Downton Abbey in space, which I can also, I guess I can agree with. It feels a bit Vorkosigan Saga. If you like the Vorkosigan Saga, you'll love this book. It's really at that level. And if you've not read the first book, read the first book first, because this won't make very much sense at all if you've not read the first book. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars, which brings me on to, normally I do an Audible ad, but I didn't listen to this one as an audiobook. I listened to it as a... I read it just as an ebook. The reason I read the first book, Ancillary Justice, as an ebook is because it didn't have an audiobook version by the time I actually wanted to read it, because loads of people were saying, hey, you should read this book. And I was like, I will. No audiobook, so I just read it. And then it was actually the same time I was looking for an audiobook and accidentally bought The Wheel of Time, book one. And I was looking through and I was like, oh, Ancillary Sword. I was planning on reading that at some point. And I read the review on Audible, and people were like, oh, really bad narrator. And someone else was like, oh, can't pronounce any of the names right, not getting, oh, this is a bad narrator. And I was like, okay, I'll just go over to Amazon, get the Kindle ebook, and that's what I did. But what I do find interesting of this is that the design of the cover. So I don't normally review covers of books, but here, Ancillary Justice, and you have a red spaceship flying downwards across a background of generic widgety spaceship. Much bigger spaceship and maybe a moon in the background. And then Ancillary Sword, it's like the red spaceship is flying like across to the left, like from right to left. And I was like, ah, I bet you we've had a red spaceship flying down the book, and now we've had a red spaceship flying across the book. And I was like, the follow-up book, like the final book in the trilogy, is called Ancillary Mercy. And I was like, I wonder if this book has got a red spaceship going diagonally across the book. And then I looked at it here on Goodreads, and there it is. Ancillary Mercy, red spaceship going diagonally across the book. So I think, you know, the first book, a straight down, oh, good, like this second book, we're going to the left, very lefty politics. And hopefully the complexity of the third book I've not read any reviews of it, but it's kind of like an angled book. There's a spaceship's flying at an angle. I'm hopefully, oh, maybe there's going to be a slightly different angle in the third book. It's not going to be straight like this or straight like that. There's going to be some more subtlety, hopefully there. So yeah, but if you do want to listen to this audiobook, you can. If you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can start a free trial with audible.com. And if you sign up for a free trial, you get a free book. And if you continue on with the trial, you get a book a month, and also a good benefit of getting a subscription, a membership to Audible, like I have, is that if you start a book and you don't like it, or you don't like the narrator for any reason, or you just don't like the book or anything like that, you can just return the book, and they'll just give you your credit back, and you can spend that credit on a different book. No questions asked by Audible. It's a fantastic service. I did that myself. With the Wheel of Time book, I was like, whoa, that's a mistake. Check it out, audibletrial.com/SFB. And by doing that, you get a free audiobook, you get a fantastic service, and also you help support the podcast here, the SFBIP. And the next book that I'm going to be reviewing is the second book in, well, I'm not sure if it's going to be the next book I review. It's the new book that I got on Audible, is called The Dead House Gates, by Stephen Erickson. It's a tale of the Malazan Book of the Fallen, number 2. And I enjoyed the first book, and this is kind of just dropping straight back into it. And I was like, ah, I know these characters, I know this situation. let's get on with it. So I'm enjoying that one so far, even though I'm only about 10% of the way into the book. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. You can become my friends on goodreads.com and join the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads and check out some of the threads there. We're chatting about different things. Books that you'd like to see reviewed is the thread to go to talk among other people that you'd books that you'd like to see me reviewed and to get other people to agree with the books that you'd like me to review and read them of you. Email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get, and that's about it for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.